These are remarkable stories.
One, two, three, four.
David Gluckman is probably a genius, and he's certainly funny. He is the inventor of so many best-selling drinks, from Bailey's Irish Cream Liqueur to Smirnoff Black to dozens of other well-known names that over the years have gotten you wrecked, bombed, wasted, hammered, and otherwise inebriated. He grew up in South Africa, but left apartheid to head to London, arriving just as the 60s were starting to swing. Mike McDowell spoke to David via Zoom, but the audio's pretty flippin' good. Here they are.
Three, two, one, yeah!
My name is David Gluckman. I spent most of my life creating new products for people, but now I'm an author and a talker. I was born on the 1st of November 1938, and I looked up to see if anything else happened that was of any importance, and what I came up with was it was a famous race between Seabiscuit and War Admiral at Pimlico Park in Baltimore. That occurred on the same day, but nothing else of particular note. I was born in a place called Port Elizabeth, which is a coastal city in South Africa. I was brought up in a Jewish family who were extremely unorthodox, so we had bacon sandwiches once a week. My parents were very, I would say, normal people. They were very concerned about what other people thought and what other people said. My father wasn't particularly successful. He went from job to job and never succeeded in any of them. But we were a pretty happy household, I think.
What were some of those jobs that your father did? What do you remember?
He did various things. He started out working in a wool company, which was owned by his father. But then when I was about 6 years old, at the end of the war, we emigrated to Johannesburg, which is South Africa's major city. It's inland. It's about 750 miles from Port Elizabeth. My father went into construction, something he knew absolutely nothing about, and this was a failure. He then went into Hessian sacking for some reason. And that wasn't particularly successful either. He ended up as an estate agent, which he did for about 10 years. And then in 1956, with his tail between his legs, he went back to Port Elizabeth and worked for his brother in the family business.
And what about your mum? Did she work?
My mother never worked. My mum belonged to that generation of people that never did any work, never took a job. She was a housewife, a mother, a cook. She was actually, I think, quite bright. But really, she was an unemancipated woman whose potential was never realized.
Were you close, you and your mom, or you and your father?
Not particularly. I was closer to my mother than my father. My father was an incredibly opinionated man for someone who'd achieved so little. He had opinions on almost anything and everything. And he read. I can't believe anybody could have read as many books as he did. He read 7 or 8 books a week.
What? More than one book a day?
He did. He would read books all the time, and the books were rubbish. most of them. Very few of them were non-fiction. They were all fiction, and they were, he consumed thrillers. People like Peter Cheney and John Creasy, who were popular thriller writers in the 1940s and 50s. And I can remember sometimes I would go back home to South Africa and I'd see a book I quite liked and I'd say, do you mind if I read that, Dad? And he said, no. He said, I think I may be coming on to that tomorrow, so I don't want you to interrupt my flow. It's very opinionated. He would point his index finger and say, let me tell you, my boy, and then pronounce on almost anything. He was okay. He was quite a nice guy, really. Well, I wasn't very close.
Was it a happy childhood?
Yeah, it was pretty happy, pretty enjoyable. I think we had a very close family life. Lots of relatives lived nearby, saw lots of cousins, aunts and uncles. I was the eldest grandchild on both sides of our family, my mother's and my father's. My mother's background is quite interesting because her father was a judge. He was a professor of law who eventually became a judge. He studied at Cambridge at the turn of the 20th century and I think got the fourth highest marks in law. He was a lovely man. He hated music and adored cricket.
What's your strongest memory of childhood?
Oh, I think going to Johannesburg, into this new city. We lived in a place called Hillbrow, which is one of those parts of Johannesburg where if you need guns or drugs, Hillbrow is the place to get them. And I remember going back to the block of flats that I lived in, and the place was like a war zone. All the windows were boarded up. And it was actually a very pleasant place in which to live when I was there in the mid-40s. Living in a block of flats, one had several friends who were all accessible just by taking the lift or walking around the corner. And I had a very enjoyable childhood, dominated by playing cricket and rugby and football, usually in busy city streets. But it was a very urban life, and I enjoyed that. We'd go to the movies on a Saturday morning and exchange comics. You'd take massive piles of American Dell comics and swap them with other kids. It was fun.
Were you academic as well as sporty?
I wasn't really academic. I learned to read quite early, and I read loads of books. And every time anybody asked me what I wanted for Christmas or for a birthday, I would always take subscriptions to comics. And in those days, the comics were more text than there were pictures. So, and they were all English too. As a kid, there were Radio Fun and Film Fun. And then later it was Hotspur, Champion, Wizard, Adventure, and Rover. And I got all these on a Thursday and took them home and read them avidly. But I wouldn't say I was studious. I think lots of my classical knowledge came from American classic comics, which I consumed in vast quantities.
You come across now, anyway, as a pretty confident and assertive individual. Were you like that as a kid?
No, I don't think I was. I think I was the sort of background. I had an unfortunate early schooling because I was at a kindergarten until the age of eight. And that was because my mother was trying to get me into a particular school. And they had quotas for people who were of my ethnicity. And I couldn't get into the school. So she kept me in this kindergarten for 2 years longer than, which is probably illegal, I think, in hindsight. But so I started school at the age of eight with kids who were a year older and a lot more sophisticated than I was, I think. And that set me back for a bit.
Were you popular, though?
No, I was a background guy. I wasn't a leader. I was a follower.
And how did you get on at school? Did you do well in the end?
I got on averagely. I think I got very ordinary matriculation results. I think two Bs and four Ds. But by virtue of my skin color, I qualified to go to university. You could do anything in South Africa if you were white.
Right, sure. So where did you go to university?
I went to university in Johannesburg it's called the University of the Witwatersrand, or WITS, as it's commonly known. My mother had an idea that I should be educated. They also had a vague suspicion that I should do law. And in South Africa, they used Roman Dutch law as the basis of the legal system. So therefore, I went to university and I had to study Latin for 1 year in order that I could understand the Justinian, or whoever it was who made the laws in South Africa. And I took 3 years of English because I was interested in English and English literature. I took 3 years of psychology because my uncle was a psychologist and he suggested it. And I thought, well, why not? And then for the rest of the time, I took subjects which were kind of fillers. So in the first year, I took English, psychology, Latin, and I think history of art, because I think the lectures were infrequent and I figured I could bullshit my way through it. In the second year, I changed universities and went down to Grahamstown because my parents had moved to Port Elizabeth and Grahamstown was about 80 miles away. And I didn't like the university. I thought it was more like a boarding school than a university. So for my final year, I went back to Johannesburg and read Psychology 3, English 3, and History of Music. And I managed not to get my degree because I treated some subjects fairly lightheartedly. But bear in mind, I was only about 19, and I was probably quite young for my age at the time. And we had Anglo-Saxon as part of our English course. And I thought, well, I'd see if I could wing it through Anglo-Saxon. And I clearly couldn't. So I got an incredibly poor score for my Anglo-Saxon paper, and that failed me English and therefore failed me my degree. But I decided at the end of it that, as I've said to you, my degree set me up perfectly for playing Trivial Pursuit and doing pub quizzes. It gave me a broad general education, but it didn't give me a qualification to do anything.
It's very interesting to hear about your time at university. But you mentioned, before you started talking about university, that you could do anything if you were white. And I wondered how it felt for you to grow up in South Africa under apartheid. And did it have a profound effect on you?
It did have a very strong effect on me. My parents were, I would call them soft liberals. In other words, they were polite to black people, but I don't think they acknowledged that they were equal. I felt rather differently about this. As a child, for example, I was in a position from the age of 11 or 12 where I could write a pass to the guy who worked for us, which said, this entitles Mr. Frans Ramalatsu to journey to the center of Johannesburg, but he must be back by 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. And I had the power to do this, and I thought that was terribly wrong, profoundly wrong, that someone of my age could give permission to an adult just because he was a different color. And I found apartheid extremely offensive, but I lived with it, as most white people in South Africa did. I only became political and more active when I got to university, because my last year at university was 1958. And in 1958, up until then, the university was integrated. So for the first time in my life, I was dealing with Africans and Indians on an equal basis. We shared classes, we sat in the canteen and had food together. And we were very actively engaged in university politics. I mean, I was never a leader. I was always a follower. But we used to go to Communist Party get-togethers and stuff like that. And when I left university, we had a flat. And flats were always ideal for political meetings because the police couldn't identify the cars. And I remember having the Congress of Democrats meeting in our flat, and some black guy was talking about the streets running with white man's blood and driving the white man into the sea. And I was offering him tea and saying, what a lump or two. It was kind of strange. But we were actively engaged in trying to keep the university integrated. We had a referendum where 95% of students said, we want to keep the university integrated, but it was completely ignored.
So what happened? It was deintegrated.
Oh, I think from 1959 onwards, all the black, coloured and Indian students were sent off to universities where people of their own colour were. They were less well equipped than the white universities, but that was the government's desire to keep society separated.
I mean, it's 60 years later, 60 years after your university was deintegrated, and it just feels like we haven't really moved on.
No, not at all. I mean, I remember, you know, coming to South Africa and seeing a black man and a white woman sitting in a restaurant, and a real lump occurred in my throat. I just, you know, just felt so good about it. And I remember when I first came to England, I lived in Earl's Court for a while, and there were lots of National Front meetings in Earl's Court, and they were talking about driving out the colonials. And I said, well, I'm a colonial. And they said, oh, not your type.
Because they were racist.
Yeah, because they were racist. I'm very anti-racist.
So university, you left. Did you have a plan at this point?
Well, the plan formed probably a little before I finished university. I read a book. My dad actually had a non-fiction book in the house, which he borrowed from the library. He never bought a book in his life. Said it was a total waste of money because he'd read them and get rid of them. But he had a book by a man called Martin Mayer, which was called Madison Avenue, USA. And it was about advertising. And I thought I'd read it and have a look and see what it was all about. I knew nothing about advertising. And advertising at the time had no reputation. This was 1958, I think. But it looked interesting. It looked creative. It looked like something that I might be good at. So when I left university, I had the opportunity to do a part-time job and go to early morning lectures in order to finish my degree. But I applied for a job in an advertising agency in Johannesburg. And to my surprise and delight, I was offered a job. And I sort of implied that I had a degree, although I didn't actually state it. I just listed all the subjects that I'd passed, which looked very impressive. And I was invited to join this advertising agency. And I had no idea what sort of job I would do. But the person who was my mentor and responsible for me decided that I should become what's called an account executive, which I think I remember being described as, they call them suits in London. And we were the people who buttered up the clients and acted as a kind of go-betweens between the clients and the creative people in the agency. So I would go to the creative people, brief them on something, get their work, take it and try and sell it to the client. And it's a job I did for 10 years and really intensely disliked.
And what was your life like at this point?
Well, my life was impoverished because the managing director was brought up in England and he paid me £25 a month, which was not a lot of money even in 1959. What's that funny noise?
We've been interrupted by my cat, Harry.
I remember I had a week in the copywriting department, and I was given a job to do. We had a client who manufactured fingernail clippers, and I came up with this, what I thought was an amazing line, which was a manicure to fit your pocket, And I went looking all haggard and bleary-eyed into the copy chief's office, and he said, well, you can't come and see the client who's visiting today, but I'll tell you what happens. Anyway, at the end of the day, I stood outside his office saying, how did it go? What was it? Was it okay? And he said, no. He said, the guy rejected your submission, and we are going with the world's finest fingernail clipper. So there I was. My first example of professional hubris came over something that clipped fingernails. How about that?
And clipped toenails as well, don't forget.
Didn't get into toenails. It was the manicure was my specific positioning for it.
So how old were you when your fingernail clipping line was rejected?
19.
When did you leave? Sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, I decided I couldn't go on living on £25 a month. Costs were rising. I was doing part-time jobs. So I applied for another job, and I applied for a job working in the market research department of Lever Brothers in Durban. Now, Durban was a city I knew absolutely nothing about and was incredibly excited at the prospect of going to live in a place like that by the seaside, completely different kind of cultural mix, because the African community was Zulu and there was a very strong Indian influence as well. And it was semi-tropical, so there'd be palm trees and everything. So very excited by this. I applied for the job, which came with a princely salary of £75 a month, which was huge by my standards, triple what I earned before. So I jumped into my car, which was a 1954 Peugeot 203, painted yellow, and drove 400 miles to the coast to Durban to start a job with Lever Brothers. It was very exciting. The only conclusion I had after about 9 months working there was I adored Durban, had a great place to live, had some very good friends, but I couldn't stand the job. Market research was definitely not for me. And so I decided to sell my car and buy a one-way ticket on the Cape Town Castle, which was extraordinary. There were, I think, 1,000 girls and 500 men. And the booze was incredibly cheap. Cigarettes were cheap. And on November the 3rd, 2 days after my 23rd birthday, we set sail for the UK.
I thought you were going to say you arrived by plane, but you arrived on a liner.
It was a liner. What can I say about it? I was in economy class. It cost me £37, 10 shillings for the trip. I was on the boat for 3 weeks, 1 week in Cape Town and 2 weeks at sea. We stopped en route for a day at Las Palmas. We left Cape Town, bright sunshine, blue sky, and arrived at 6 in the morning in Southampton on the 17th of November 1961. And that was a hell of a thought, because I had no idea what to expect. I had no job lined up. I knew absolutely no one in London at all. Didn't have a single person to go and borrow money from if I was short. I had a couple of £100 in my pocket from selling my car, and the great adventure began.
What did you do when you got to London? How did you begin that adventure?
I had no idea about the geography of London. I thought Tottenham Hotspur played at Tottenham Court Road. So I remember getting off the tube and saying to a news vendor, where's the football ground? And he thought I was off my head. I managed to find a flat shared with 8 people right opposite Selfridges. I had no idea where I was living, but I had a typewriter, so I just started writing letters to every advertising agency I could find to try and get a job or to try and get an interview. And during the period from the end of November to Christmas, it's a really bad time to get interviews in the ad business because they're partying for about all that time. I did manage to land a job with an ad agency, but it was a job in Kuala Lumpur. But I kept the option open, and the guy said, do come and see me after Christmas and we'll talk about detail. But unfortunately, he died during the interim, so that was the end of that job. Eventually, I think I was down to my last 5 or 10 pounds, and I walked into an ad agency in Knightsbridge. I had one suit, and I put that on, and I said to the receptionist, "Do you know if they're hiring?" And she said, "I think they are." So I said, "Well, do you think I could talk to the person interviewing? It is the MD." And I spoke to him, and he said, "Well, when can you get here?" And I said, "Well, now I'm here." So I had an interview, and much to my surprise and delight, I was employed as an account executive or an assistant account executive on Camay Soap at the princely sum of £900 a year, same as I earned in South Africa.
You speak fondly of these times. I mean, you had no money, you had one suit, you were down to your last £5, you were living in a shared flat, and it just, you know, it sounds as though you were relatively impoverished, but it was fun, right?
Well, my best mate from Durban suddenly appeared out of the blue. I had no idea he was coming. In those days, communication was really difficult. There was no internet. Telephone calls were £1 a minute. And you had to book them 24 hours in advance. And suddenly he had come too to seek his fortune. I had a friend, which was good. And I'd met a couple of people in my flat and became friendly. So, yeah, it was great. I had a job. I was employed. I belonged to something. I was going to be English-ish.
And you were chasing women and getting drunk and smoking cigarettes.
Absolutely. All of the above. Somebody said once, if you remember the 60s, you probably weren't there. And I suppose that's true. But the world was changing. I mean, women were on the pill, so you were no longer terrified of sex.
Were people terrified of sex before the contraceptive pill came along?
I think they were. I mean, I was anyway. I was a very, you know, when I was 19, 20, I mean, it's probably the equivalent of a 12-year-old today. No, London was a good place to be, and it was, we had a lot of fun. And working in an agency, immediately you had a built-in group of friends, and I kept quite a few of them. A lot of them died as well, unfortunately. Rather careless, I think.
Well, look, you're best known, I suppose, for better or worse, as a designer of drinks, as the man who invented Baileys. And I wonder, how long did you remain an ad man, and how did you transition?
Well, it happened like this. I worked in this agency, which was called Benton & Bowles, for 5 years. I worked on an extraordinarily interesting account, which was Kerrygold Butter. It was a very charismatic Irishman, aged about 28, who was the general manager of the Irish Dairy Board. He was called Tony O'Reilly, and he was a famous rugby player. But he was also a brilliant man. And he came to the agency and said that they wanted to transform Irish butter from a commodity into a brand. So we transformed Irish butter into Kerrygold butter, which enabled them to get higher prices, and it gave them a presence, it gave it an identity. Now, I won't pretend that I was a prime mover in this. I was very much a junior member of the team that created the brand. But working with O'Reilly was one of the most exciting periods in my working life. So I needed to give you this as a bit of background. I stayed in the agency for about 5 years, and when they didn't put my salary up from 1,800 to 2,000, but only to 1,900, in a fit of pique, I decided to go out and seek my fortune. So I applied for another job with an agency that had offices in Paddington. So I crossed the park. That wasn't very successful. Quite often, if you've had a very good job and you go somewhere else, it doesn't work out quite so well. So I took another job with an advertising agency. By this time, I was hardwired as an account man, and I was just turning 30, so it was very difficult for me to change my function. I worked in this agency for a couple of years and decided, I think about the age of 30, that I had no future as an account man, because the direction account men took was towards the main board and the management of the agency, and I wasn't really interested in this. I was only interested in ideas. So I went to my boss in the agency and said, look, why don't we set up a department to help companies develop new products? I knew very little about the subject, although I'd read a bit. And I did a business plan to the guy, and the MD said, I think it's a great idea. Why didn't we go ahead and do it? So that was the beginning. And I was then sent on a seminar to Stresa on Lake Maggiore, and met a lot of people. And one of the people who came along to address us was a man from a drinks company. And because I was an English speaker, one of the few at the seminar, I was assigned to take him out to dinner. And we had a delightful dinner. We spent 2 hours just looking at bottles up in the back bar. So I said to him, we've got this new department to help companies develop new products. Would you like to give us your business? And he said, yeah, we really had hit it off very well. So he immediately appointed us to look after his new product business. And that's how the whole thing started.
So what was the step then that took you to the supermarket and then stirring cream and Irish whiskey together in your kitchen?
We started the department in 1969 in the agency. There were two of us, a fellow called Hugh Seymour Davies, a very fine gentleman who was educated at Eton and Merton College at Oxford. He was a lovely man, a self-confessed snob, an elitist, but he and I, because we were so very different, hit it off magnificently. We worked in the agency for about 3 years running this department, and then we both decided that it was going quite well, and why didn't we set this thing up on our own? So I went to the drinks client and said to him, if we set up on our own, would you give us your business? Now, I've always been a particularly lousy businessman, and at the time, they were paying the agency £2,000 a month. So I said, well, we'll do it for £1,000. So I really betrayed my ethnic origins, I think, because I was a bad negotiator. And anyway, he said, absolutely, that's fine. We'll do it. We started in April the 1st, 1973, and we had a brief immediately, which came in. We called it the Wexford Whisper because it wasn't written down. It had been passed on from a number of people. The Irish government had brought out a law or a piece of legislation which said that any company who developed brands which were primarily exported would be given a 10-year tax holiday. So in other words, you develop an export brand, you wouldn't pay taxes on that brand for 10 years. And this brief came through to us. What we were going to, that's all it said. It didn't say it had to be this or it had to be that or it needed to target this or that. It was simply, we want a drink to export from Ireland. Period. That was it. And I remember my partner coming in on a Monday morning. He lived just south of the river. I lived in Cock Foster's. I was always in the office at 8, which meant I got up at about 6. He strolled in usually at about 9:45. And our approaches were completely different. I mean, I think I lived to work, and Hugh definitely worked to live. Anyway, he came in. I'd been in the office for an hour and a half. He sloped in, made himself coffee, opened his mail, and sat down and looked at me and said, and what are we going to do this week? Which is what he always did. And I was totally pissed off at this. So I said, well, what are we going to do about this bloody Irish brief, which we discussed the previous week? But he'd completely forgotten it. We chatted for a while, and I said to him, do you think there's anything in my experience of Kerrygold which might have some impact on the brief? You know, is there anything we could do with that? And he said, well, what happens if you mix Irish whiskey and cream. What would that taste like? So I said, if there's only one way to find out, let's go down to international stores at the bottom of Berwick Market. We'll buy some cream, we'll buy a small bottle of Jameson's, come back to the office, mix them, and see what they taste like. And that's what we did. And the concoction was truly awful. So I said, okay, back to the supermarket, we've got to find some other stuff to add to it. And we looked around the shelves and found powdered drinking chocolate, Cadbury's drinking chocolate. So brought that back to the office, added some sugar, messed about with the proportions. I said, look, this doesn't taste half bad. I think I'm going to go along and tell the IDV people about it and see what they think. And I said, do you want to come? So he said, no, I don't think so. He said, some kind of chocolate concoction. I don't think they're going to like this too much. So I said, well, I'll take a chance. I think it's great. And I hopped in a cab, went to IDV, met my friend Tom Jago, talked to him about the idea. He tasted it. He said, that tastes fantastic. I think we should do it. And I think it was then that I realized that the real heroes of ideas, they're the people who buy them. And I thought, you know, what a ballsy thing to do. I mean, this is a pretty wacky product. We had no idea whether it could be made or what it would end up like or how much it would cost to manufacture. But he said, let's try it. He had that great can-do experimental attitude, which was very much part of IDV, as I was later to discover. So that was the beginning of Baileys.
And how many bottles of Baileys have been consumed since it first went on sale?
I think it hit the billion mark in about, I've got a figure somewhere in the book. I mean, Baileys last year sold 7.1 million cases, which is 84 million bottles worldwide. It's the largest, the biggest selling liqueur brand in the world. And it's about 43% of the total cream liqueur market. So I think we didn't only create Baileys, we created the whole market, because there's still 57% of the market is other people's cream liqueurs.
Given, I mean, was there immediate success? And did this launch you as a beverage designer?
No, it didn't, because I think what people don't realise is that in categories like drinks, they take quite a long time to happen. They aren't overnight. There are very few drinks that are overnight success. If it takes 5 years, particularly in those days, that was pretty good. So by the time Baileys became internationally known, there were hundreds of people who'd taken credit for coming up with the idea, as so often happens.
What's your favourite of all the drinks you've invented, the brands you've created? What's your favourite one?
Oh, well, there were loads of them. I suppose one of my favourites is something that never even got onto the drawing board, let alone off it. When IDV merged with Guinness UD to form Diageo, there was a lot of kind of hands across the sea interfacing between the various departments in the two companies. And one of the briefs that people got engaged with was the possibility of developing a Guinness whiskey. So I went along to the meeting and there was a long discussion as to whether it should be Irish whiskey or Scotch whiskey. And I suddenly thought, why are we bothering about Guinness whiskey? Why don't we simply take Guinness and distill it? And the product would become distilled Guinness. I love that idea, though. I still do.
I would like to try it.
I would like to make it first.
You are a person who is curious about the world. And I wonder, how important is it to maintain that curiosity, to stay interested?
Well, I think at my age, it's incredibly important. If I stop doing that, the machine stops.
So you were an ad man, and then from the late 60s on, you were an inventor of mostly alcoholic beverages. And now you are an author. And is reinvention, reinventing yourself, is it the secret? Is it what keeps you sharp?
I think it is. I mean, also one of the things I've done, my book seems to have become extremely popular amongst young startup companies. And I get letters all the time from people who said, I've just started a business and I've just read your book and I think it's great. Could you give me some advice? And I'm always happy to do that. So anyone who buys my book can get an hour of my time at no charge, longer if necessary. And I'm very happy to help them. And that has stimulated me also. You know, talking to young guys making peanut butter, that's a lot of fun. That keeps you going.
What's next for you?
Well, I've got two more books that I'm playing with at the moment. The first one is about showing big companies, big corporations, that they can act and operate like small startups. If I have the time, I'm going to write one more book, which is Everything I Ever Knew About New Products. I mean, there's a lot of it in That Shit Will Never Sell, but I have more.
Well, I look forward to reading that too. That Shit Will Never Sell is a fantastic book. I would recommend it to anybody. It's not just it's not merely a masterclass in the creation of drinks and drinks brands. It's a really good read and it's really funny. David Gluckman, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Right. That was bloody great.
Remarkable Stories is written and produced by John Herlig and Mike McDowell. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend or leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen. From everybody at Remarkable Stories, I'm Georgina Milsom saying thank you for listening.